The acceptance paradox is a spiritual technique that works in the opposite way. Instead of defending against the negative thought, you find some truth in it. You agree with it, but with a sense of humor, inner peace, and enlightenment. You actually befriend the critic in your mind. You can mix and match or blend these two styles of responding, but when the negative thoughts lead to feelings of worthlessness, inferiority, shame, or a loss of self-esteem, the acceptance paradox will usually be vastly more effective than the self-defense paradigm. If you use the acceptance paradox, you might talk back to the negative thought like this. As a matter of fact, I do have many defects. There's no doubt about it. I accept that. This removes the sting from the criticism and ends the debate. Now, suppose that the inner critic relentlessly keeps trying to bash you. You can just stick to your guns, using the acceptance paradox, as in this example. Negative thoughts. It's not just that you have a few specific flaws or defects. Face it, you're globally flawed. You're a defective human being. Positive thoughts. You're right. It took me years to figure that out, but you got it right away. And you know something else? My defectiveness is actually one of my better characteristics. In this case, we're pulling the teeth out of the monster's mouth and making a cosmic joke. So what if you are defective? Will they refuse to sell you a cup of coffee in New York? Will your friends stop hanging out with you? The acceptance paradox is based on the Buddhist principle that when you defend yourself, you create an instant state of war. The moment you defend yourself, you invite another attack. Of course, the critic you're fighting is the negative part of your own brain, so you end up at war with yourself. In contrast, when you find the truth in a criticism, it loses its power over you. Most religions, including Christianity, have emphasized that all human beings are flawed and defective. That's the human condition. The Navajos have a rule that every rug they weave must contain some defect or imperfection, or else the gods will get mad and punish them. But it's possible to experience joy and enlightenment in spite of our flawed nature. The acceptance paradox is one way to transform this idea into an emotional reality. At first, it may be difficult to see why or how the acceptance paradox could be helpful. Lots of people who suffer from anxiety or depression think they've already accepted themselves. They believe they're facing the awful truth about themselves and feel like they really are hopeless, worthless losers. This is unhealthy acceptance, and it's radically different from healthy acceptance. You can view your defectiveness as a reason for suicide or a cause for celebration. You can accept it with joy or despair. Once you let go of the idea that you're supposed to be special, that you're supposed to have self-esteem, and that you're supposed to live up to your ideal self and be exactly the way you think you should be, you'll experience freedom, joy, and enlightenment. Exposure therapy is based on a legend in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. According to this legend, after you die, you'll wake up in a dark place. Out of the darkness, a terrifying monster will suddenly appear. The monster will represent all the worst fears you've ever had. For each person, the monster will be different, since we all have different fears and vulnerabilities. When the monster appears, you'll have two choices. You can try to get away, or you can surrender. If you try to get away, you will escape, but just barely, and soon you'll be lost in the dark again. Out of the darkness, a second monster will emerge. This one will be almost as terrifying as the first, but not quite, and you'll be faced with the same choice: surrender or flee. If you try to escape, you'll succeed, but you'll soon find yourself in the dark again. Every time you escape, another terrifying monster will appear. Each monster will be slightly less terrifying than the one before, and if you run, you'll always just barely manage to get away. According to the legend, If you run away from all the monsters, you'll be reincarnated as something very lowly, like a worm. If you surrender to one of the monsters, you'll be reincarnated at a higher level. The scarier the monster you surrender to, the greater your status in your next life will be. In the event that you surrendered to the first and most terrifying monster, two things would happen. First, you'd discover that the monster was not real. You'd realize that it was just an illusion and that you never had anything to fear in the first place. The discovery might also seem incredibly funny, and you'd probably start laughing because you'd realize that your fears had been the result of a gigantic cosmic joke that had persisted throughout all of your previous reincarnations. Second, you wouldn't have to go through the life-death cycle anymore. Instead of being reincarnated, you'd be transported to a higher plane of existence, such as Nirvana. Although this is just a legend, it contains a great deal of truth. If you want to gain complete liberation from your fears, you'll have to confront the monster you fear the most. This is the essence of exposure therapy. Avoidance keeps your anxiety alive, and exposure will lead to the cure. There are three basic types of exposure therapy: classical exposure, cognitive exposure, and interpersonal exposure. The techniques you use will depend on the nature of your fears. All forms of exposure require tremendous courage, but the results will be well worth the discomfort you'll have to endure. Let's focus on three classical exposure techniques: gradual exposure, flooding, and response prevention. One of my psychiatric students, Dr. Anthony Mascola, was recently treating a 31-year-old woman named Magdalena who had a blood and needle phobia. Magdalena was very motivated to overcome her blood and needle phobia because she didn't want to get panicky and faint every time she visited her husband in the hospital. She and Dr. Mascola decided to try gradual exposure. Together, they developed a fear hierarchy. They listed a variety of feared situations involving blood and needles and rated them on a scale from 1, the least frightening, to 10, the most frightening. The first item on Magdalena's fear hierarchy is simply imagining that she's waiting to have her blood drawn. This is called cognitive flooding. Cognitive flooding involves imagining the thing you fear as vividly as possible and flooding yourself with anxiety without trying to fight or control it. Dr. Mascola told Magdalena to close her eyes, relax, and picture the scene. He said, "Imagine that you're at the clinical laboratory waiting to have your blood drawn. Can you see the room? The phlebotomist just walked in, and he's carrying his equipment on a tray. You can see the tourniquet, the rubbing alcohol, the tubes for the blood, and the needle. He looks nervous and explains that he's a medical student. Now he's applying the rubber tourniquet to your arm and telling you to clench your fist to make your veins pop up. He's cleaning your arm with an alcohol swab. Now he's looking for a vein. You can see the tip of the needle. He's moving it toward your arm. He's about to stick it in. Now he's sticking your arm, but he can't find a vein. He apologizes and explains that he's only done this once or twice before, and he'll have to try again." Magdalena's anxiety shot up to 100%. Dr. Mascola continued with this technique throughout the session. At the end of the session, Magdalena still found the fantasy extremely anxiety-provoking. Dr. Mascola instructed Magdalena to visualize the scene at home for 15 minutes each day. After practicing on her own several times, Magdalena noticed that her anxiety became less intense. Before long, she was unable to make herself anxious when she imagined the scene. Next, Magdalena tackled level 2 on her fear hierarchy. She wrote a detailed description of a time when she had her blood drawn and fainted. She never allowed herself to think about this because it was so anxiety-provoking. She got anxious when she began to write about it, but her anxiety had almost completely disappeared by the time she was done 20 minutes later. Magdalena moved up to level 3 on her fear hierarchy. Dr. Mascola brought some equipment for drawing blood to the therapy session, and Magdalena looked at it without touching it. Her anxiety shot up to 100%, but after a few minutes, she could look at the equipment without much anxiety at all. Next, Magdalena handled the equipment for several minutes, level 4, and then let Dr. Mascola touch her arm with the capped tip of the needle, level 5. Once again, her anxiety zoomed up to 100%, but fell to nearly 0% within 5 minutes. Then she removed the cap from the needle and let Dr. Mascola touch the inside of her arm with the tip of the needle, level 6. Her anxiety shot up to 100%, but quickly fell almost all the way to 0 again. Eventually, Magdalena completed level 9 on her fear hierarchy and said she was ready for level 10, donating blood at the blood bank near her home in Sacramento. This involved lying on a table for 30 minutes with a needle in her vein. Magdalena forced herself to look at the needle and watch the blood flowing from her vein the entire time. She didn't get lightheaded or experience any anxiety at all. You can complete your own fear hierarchy. List the least threatening activity as level 1 and the most frightening activity as level 10. Try to make the anxiety as bad as you can for as long as you can at each step on your fear hierarchy. In most cases, the anxiety will eventually diminish and disappear. At that point, you'll suddenly realize that you've conquered the monster.